It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Rob Ferret. Veronica Rickert is out today. Coming up later, we'll check out the latest state job numbers, which appear to be on the rise. First, it's time for our weekly review of state news. President Obama visited Wisconsin this week to talk about the benefits of his health care law. In the state legislature, lawmakers considered Governor Scott Walker's college affordability bills. And an interesting story is brewing involving Weedick, Wisconsin Manufacturers and Commerce, and Kraft Heinz. Here with us now to take a closer look at these stories is Robert Mentzer. He's storytelling editor for the USA Today Network Wisconsin. He's based in Wausau. Rob, thanks for joining us again today.
Hey, Rob, it's great to be back.
Well, there's this economic story developing involving the closure of the Oscar Mayer plant in Madison that was announced a while back. Some new information out here about communication between the state's jobs agency, the Wisconsin Economic Development Corporation, a lobbying group for business, Wisconsin Manufacturers and Commerce over this issue. So in a nutshell, what happened?
Yeah, so this is a pretty surprising story. It's a good piece of open records reporting by Matthew DeFore of the Wisconsin State Journal. What he found, he dug up some emails that showed that a few months before Kraft Heinz decided to close that that Madison Oscar Mayer plant, a guy from the Wisconsin Economic Development Corporation had met with a member of the business lobbying giant Wisconsin Manufacturers and Commerce, and the WMC said, "No, we don't see really a need. We don't think you need to meet with Kraft Heinz at the moment." And so they didn't. And then a few months later, the surprising news, shocking news that that this Madison Oscar Mayer plant was going to close. So that looks bad if you are a Weedick guy. On the other hand, I mean, in fairness, what the emails show is that Weedick at the time was most concerned that Kraft Heinz might be closing a plant in Beaver Dam. Mm-hmm. Apparently, was not aware at all that there was an issue with the Madison plant. Still, I mean, it doesn't speak well.
And some Democrats and Madison's mayor Paul Soglin not happy. They say Weedick fell down on the job here. Some calling for a state legislative investigation. So, what's been the angry response on that side?
Yeah, I mean, it's certainly the news that it would close was a shock at the time last fall in November. That is a plant that has a history in Madison and is very sort of recognizable and is an institution. Another thing that people were looking at is the amount of incentives that other states had put together for this specific company. Iowa offered Kraft Heinz $4.75 million in state incentives, $10 million in local incentives to sort of help with a meat processing plant in Davenport. In New York, they were giving $20 million incentive package to retain 1,000 jobs at Kraft Heinz. And so one of the things, I mean, first one thing that it shows is just the amount of competition and the amount of leverage that companies have in these situations, but it also raises the question of whether could Wisconsin have done more? Should Wisconsin have done more? In Wisconsin, there were some local incentives from the city of Madison, but nothing from the state that was even offered.
Have we heard anything from Weedick and WMC about this?
So, I mean, mainly the defenders say that this was a discussion about a different thing, about a cheese plant in Beaver Dam, and that they weren't aware of, and maybe it wouldn't have mattered for the Madison Oscar Mayer plant, and maybe it wouldn't have. That could be true, but I think it's the general view that clearly after this conversation happened, Weedick sort of dropped the matter. And should they, is that appropriate after you meet with a business lobbyist to have let it go?
Talking about some of the top news stories of the week in Wisconsin with Rob Mentzer from USA Today Network Wisconsin. Let's move on to the legislature now, Rob. A Senate committee approved a series of college affordability bills, party line votes, as I understand it. Now, these are bills that Governor Walker has been pushing, part of his State of the State address. Refresh our memory. What would they do?
Sure. Well, there's a bunch of them. There's a probably one of the more significant ones. There's a bill that would lift the cap on the student loan interest that you can deduct on your taxes. It would take away the $2,500 cap. There's a bill that would expand need-based scholarship grants for technical colleges. There's a big waiting list for those, and also for two-year University of Wisconsin colleges. There's a bill that would create something called internship coordinators, which one assumes coordinate internships. So it's a whole bunch of different bills. I think you could characterize them as fairly small ball, sort of incremental bills, but they would start to address what has been a large issue in Wisconsin and a large political issue that Wisconsin Democrats have spoken a lot about, which is the effect that student debt has on the economy, the drag that it has.
Before we get into the Democratic response to these bills, there was some concern from Republicans, not so much that they didn't like these bills, but that we don't have a lot of wiggle room in our current budget. And even though these aren't super expensive, these put us closer to that edge. Is that something you think could still be a problem in the full Senate with the Republican majority?
Yeah, I mean, Senate Majority Leader Scott Fitzgerald says it could be a problem. The full package of bills is estimated to cost about $10 million, in the grants and new positions created and so on. So, yeah, who knows? The new revenues are verboten in the Republican legislature, and so they have a very specific number of what is left in the state budget based on projections anyway. And I would say it's fair to say it's that the future is uncertain for these bills. On the other side of things, it is a priority for Governor Scott Walker. Clearly it was important to him. It was a centerpiece of his State of the State address. So that there could be political pressure from the governor's office.
And what's been the response from the minority party, the Democrats in the legislature?
Well, basically, Democrats' view is that the legislature just got finished cutting $250 million from the UW system in the state budget last year. So, I mean, their overall view is that these are small ball bills they're nothing like a massive overhaul of how the higher education system is funded or paid for or how most people experience student loan debt. And that's the kind of big stuff that the Democrats tend to campaign on. It's not that they disagree with the substance of these bills. I haven't heard that much, but they just see it as a internship coordinators. Why not?
Finally, President Obama was in Wisconsin yesterday to push the success of his health care law, the Affordable Care Act. What was the president's general message?
So Milwaukee won the Healthy Communities Challenge by signing up 38,000 new people on healthcare.gov for 2016 insurance. And the president wanted to talk about the overall great reduction in the rate of uninsured people throughout the country. For the first time ever, the nation's uninsured rate is below 10%, and the number of uninsured overall dropped from 44.8 million people in 2013 to 28.8 million people last year. So that's a lot of progress on that uninsured rate.
President Obama had some words directed at Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker. Here's a little taste of that.
Your governor still refuses to expand Medicaid in this state, and we could cover another 21,000 Wisconsinites with a stroke of his pen. He could join 31 other governors who are taking this option, which, by the way, actually would save money.
So this has been an argument in Wisconsin and in states around the country for quite a while now. The governor has said, no, we don't think the money is reliable. We might be left kind of high and dry on that. Any reason to think that's going to change?
I mean, the sides are pretty dug in on it. It is a lot of money. We're talking about $670 million a very large number in estimates that the state has passed up by not expanding Medicaid. And so one supposes that perhaps a fiscal imperative eventually might have an effect, but it's such a ideological clash that it feels very unlikely that Republicans would come around on it.
And I want to throw this this at you before we're done, Rob. The president's opening act yesterday, the person who introduced him, a man from Mozanie, just down the road a piece from you there in Wausau.
Right.
What did you know about that story?
Yeah, it's fascinating. Brent Brown of Mozanie, he's 33 years old. He wrote a letter to the president last year in June saying that he's a lifelong Republican and had voted against Obama, had campaigned against Obama, then was diagnosed with an autoimmune disease. He ran out of money for treatment, and he said, Brent Brown said that he literally did not think he would be alive today were it not for his ability to get insurance coverage under the Affordable Care Act. So, I mean, that is pretty striking. He's strongly anti-abortion guy and still considers himself a Republican, but he was up on the stage introducing President Obama and saying about as strong as terms as you can that he was wrong about Obamacare.
We'll leave it there for now, Rob. As always, thanks for joining us.
Thanks a lot.
That's Rob Mentzer, storytelling editor for the USA Today Network Wisconsin, based in Wausau. He joins us every week at this time to round up top news stories from around the state. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. New job numbers out this week from the state's Department of Workforce Development seem to show some promising news for the state's economy. From September 2014 to September 2015, the state added just over 30,000 private sector jobs. That's a 10% increase from the previous 12-month period. Wages have gone up as well, according to the same data, and new national numbers show better than expected job growth for the month of February. So, good news for Wisconsin, and what's behind the increases? Here with us now to discuss the latest job numbers is Brian Jacobson. He's chief portfolio strategist at Wells Fargo Funds and an associate professor at Wisconsin Lutheran College. Brian, welcome back to the show.
Oh, thank you for having me back.
Well, put this in perspective, Brian, 30,000 sounds like a decent number of jobs added in that one-year span. Is that something we should view as a positive or trailing behind what we might be hoping for?
Well, I think that it is a positive if you kind of look at the longer trajectory. You know, the 30,000 doesn't really sound like a lot, and a little bit of context around that if you kind of consider that in Wisconsin itself, the level of employment is obviously significantly lower than it is in larger populated states like Illinois and the such. But we have, you know, 2.4 million employees in Wisconsin as of the end of 2014. That's some of the more recent data that we have, compared to 116 million nationwide. And so the 30,000, that's a big improvement over what it was, say, even a year ago. A year ago, a lot of people were talking about how slow the pace of job creation was in Wisconsin, and it really did seem to almost kick it up a notch here over the last year. Part of that is just because of the good job gains that we've seen nationwide. A lot of what happens in Wisconsin tends to be driven very much by national trends, and not necessarily anything that's like idiosyncratic or very specific to Wisconsin itself.
If I can be a bit wonky and nerdy here, let's look at what these numbers are. In the last couple governor's elections, there's been a lot of look at jobs numbers. There are the monthly numbers, which people say aren't quite as reliable, and then there are the these numbers, this thing that's more reliable, but it comes out usually 6 or so months after the fact. These are the better numbers, though they're a little old by now. Is that right, Brian?
Yeah, there's sort of this trade-off as far as the economic data. If you want the data sooner, they tend to not be as reliable. If you're willing to wait, you get a lot more respondents. You get a lot more analysis going into it. And so the monthly numbers coming out, the reason why the newspaper articles oftentimes look at these quarterly data series is because it's based upon survey in basically 96 to 98% of all employers. Whereas if you look at the monthly numbers, like, for example, you can go out there and see what was the job gains back in December. Those are based on a very small sample size. So they want to get the data out there quickly so people can start making, you know, decisions based on it. But the downside to that quickness is it's not quite as reliable.
So do we know if there are particular sectors of the Wisconsin job market that are driving this growth?
You know, a lot of it has been the same story as what we've had across the United States, which is that manufacturing has actually done pretty well. It's interesting if you look at the service sector across the United States compared to Wisconsin itself. The service sector in Wisconsin is slightly smaller. That's why a lot of people think about Wisconsin being a manufacturing economy. But manufacturing is really only about 19% of total employment in Wisconsin. Compare that to nationwide, which is around 10.5%. So we're not exactly, where 50% are manufacturing. So when people talk about Wisconsin being a manufacturing economy, you have to put that in context. It's still only about, 20% of the overall employment. But a lot of the gains have been in manufacturing and quite a bit in construction as well. It's kind of fascinating. Just this morning, the employment situation report came out. So that's the nationwide survey. And over the last, basically since September, construction has added a significant number of jobs in residential real estate and some of the specialty trades. And Wisconsin is participating in that as well. So, you've got manufacturing, you've got construction. But I do have to say there's also some of the lower skill jobs that are being created. That's why today we saw the average hourly wage dropping, is because there were a lot of like retail, trade, and food and drinking establishment jobs that were created, which don't typically tend to be on the higher end of the spectrum as far as the hourly wages.
Talking to Brian Jacobson about economic news from Wisconsin and from around the country. He's chief portfolio strategist at Wells Fargo Funds, associate professor at Wisconsin Lutheran College. Let's stay on that wage issue, Brian. Now, the decline you just mentioned in hourly wage, that was from the national report, is that right?
Yes, that was from the national report. So it was basically a 3-cent decline in February, going from January to February. But going from December to January, there is a 12-cent increase. So it goes up one month, it might come down another. There's some reasons why maybe the number went down, not just due to the composition of jobs, perhaps because more than half of the jobs created in February were towards the lower end of the spectrum as far as with wages. But also there was a little seasonal factor, the fact that they do these surveys and it's supposed to be like as of the pay period that includes the 12th day of the month, so it included February 12th, and it just so happened that that pay period, it ended up on a Friday as opposed to a different day of the week, and there's this weird seasonal pattern where sometimes that means that the number is down a little bit. It's perhaps a response bias, because remember, these are all based on surveys of employers where they're looking at what was your payroll and what were you going to pay people. And so if they're actually doing the payroll that day or if they're doing it that week, you tend to get more accurate answers than if it's, say, it's going to be next Monday that I'm going to be doing the payroll. So you do get some of these weird response biases in some of these surveys.
Well, one big question of the recovery from the Great Recession has been, jobs seem to be coming back, maybe not as fast as we'd like, but they're coming back. But wages were lagging there for a long time. Are we seeing any kind of steady growth in wages?
There is, yes, even though wages aren't growing that rapidly, they are still growing. So it's just the big question, I think, going into, say, from 2009 all the way through 2013 is why aren't wages going up faster? So it wasn't so much that they weren't growing, because they were. It's just that they weren't growing at the same pace as what they were historically. Even now, wages are only growing at around 2.2%. That's the most recent data that we have from the national survey, the year-on-year growth rate in the average hourly income of 2.2%, that is not close to what the Federal Reserve might prefer to see it at, which would be closer to about 3 to 3.5%. So, as far as why is that happening? Well, part of it is because there's more to a person's compensation than just their wage. There's also the cost of benefits. And so if you actually look at another indicator called the Employment Cost Index, that's a little bit more comprehensive. And because of how comprehensive it is, it's not as timely. But that's showing that total compensation, when you include benefits, that's growing at a little bit faster pace at around 3.5%. So it's still not at the historical averages, but this is not a historically average economic recovery either.
But if I could throw a bad news spin, that means if I'm an employer and I'm paying my employees the same amount, but the health care premiums I'm paying my portion of for them goes up, that's going to bring up that number, but none of us are going to feel any happier about that.
Yeah, that is one of the problems with when your compensation is more than just your wage. People, employees maybe don't value some of those other benefits as much as what it costs the employer to provide. It was very interesting listening to the previous segment as far as when you were talking about the Affordable Care Act, as far as the effect that that's had on the cost of insurance and the mandate and the such as, would people maybe be further off receiving that as cash from their employer and then buying it on some sort of exchange instead? But that's more of a political decision. But you're absolutely correct that the employer costs are increasing. Now, I do have to say, though, health insurance costs have not been going up as quickly as they historically had been. So coming out of this with this economic recovery, health insurance costs have been going up, but not at the same rapid pace as previous to this recovery. Part of that, maybe it's attributable to the Affordable Care Act, but a big part of it is also probably just due to how slow the economic recovery is.
And Brian, just in our last minute here, we've talked state, we've talked national. Let's put this in an international context. The U.S. economy, we could look at it and say, gosh, this isn't much of a recovery. It's going really slowly. But some people said, yeah, well, compared to Japan, China, Eurozone, we're looking pretty good. How do you read that?
Well, that's absolutely correct. If you were to just say, look at from 2010 to 2015, the United States, the per annum growth rate for GDP was around 2.1%, whereas in other advanced economies like Japan and Europe, it averaged around 1.8%. So we are growing faster, although it could certainly be better. Global growth has been around 3.8 to 4%, which is slower than what it was in the pre-financial crisis period. But there are early signs, I think, of manufacturing especially beginning to emerge from what I've referred to as this winter period for manufacturing. It's been this slowdown, but there are early signs that maybe that winter is turning into spring.
Brian, we'll leave it there. Thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you.
That's Brian Jacobson, Chief Portfolio Strategist at Wells Fargo Funds, Associate Professor at Wisconsin Lutheran College, breaking down some of the latest job numbers in Wisconsin and beyond. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Veronica Rickert is back with me on Monday. The new initiative spearheaded by the National League of Cities aims to get more children, especially kids in urban areas, out into nature. Madison was recently chosen as one of seven cities to participate in that program. Joining us now to talk about the initiative and the benefits that access to the outdoors has for kids, for people in general, for the community at large, we have Mary Michaud. She's the Policy Director for Public Health Madison in Dane County. Mary, thanks a lot for joining us today.
It's my pleasure, Rob.
Well, give us the basics. Exciting grant, I assume, for your department. So tell us about the initiative and what it's trying to accomplish.
Sure. So this is a partnership, really. We in public health know that big health problems can't be approached without partnership. So almost everything we do is in partnership with other folks in the community. So this one is really a key partnership in our city with the City of Madison Parks Department. We also have leadership from Alder Rebecca Kemble from the North Side. So it's been great to explore how we can move this initiative forward. The Children in Nature Network is an organization that was started within the last decade by Richard Louvre. He's an author of Last Child in the Woods. Some of mm-hmm. you might find that
familiar.
We've
heard him here on the network, I think. Yeah.
Yeah. So the Children in Nature Network teamed up with the National League of Cities to really look at the issue of connecting urban children, as you said, to nature. Now, the important thing, I think, is we're really focused on equity. So what does that mean? It means that all children deserve the chance to learn, to grow, and to establish a connection with nature. And sometimes living in a city, that's not so easy.
Let's, before we get into the details of how this will work, let's talk more about some of the benefits. What do kids get out of having access to some kind of green space or some kind of nature, and what do they miss if they don't have that access?
It's a great question, and I think a lot of us kind of recognize the obvious things. There's the physical activity. Mm-hmm. We have a real challenge in our country, and it's not unique to Madison at all, but a challenge of obesity and overweight among young people as well as adults. So that physical activity is really critical. We also have not so obvious benefits. So some of those include the fact that as kids, we use our senses to learn. So there's learning benefits. There's cognitive benefits that come from hands-on participation with the things you're learning about. The mental health benefits can be really profound. And there's more and more research coming out that really talks about restorative spaces. So if you think about kids who might live in apartments, for example, or kids who live in more crowded housing, a lot of kids are finding themselves having to be in noise, and we have media around us all the time. They hardly ever get to be around quiet spaces. And some of those quiet spaces are really only found in the middle of the woods or out in a small park where no one's around and you can just hear the birds. It comes down to being a restorative place for kids who have a lot of busyness in their lives.
So some people might hear this and think, okay, great. Everybody send your kid to a park. End of story. Why do we need to plan and develop this program for it? Why isn't it that simple?
Right. So there are a lot of historic barriers for everybody to participate in nature. Some of us go to a park and don't think a second time about it. For African Americans, I think there's a long history of not feeling welcome in certain places. For Latinos, feeling like they may not belong in certain communities, that's a historical legacy that it's really up to us to change. So being aware of those kinds of systemic and sort of long-standing biases is going to help us make some changes for kids. The other piece, I think, is getting kids involved in particular is one of the focus areas for this initiative to tell us how they want their future to look. How do we engage kids to really shape their green spaces and the nearby nature they have? So that's a big focus.
We're talking to Mary Michaud. She's Policy Director for Public Health, Madison and Dane County, talking about a new program, a grant aimed at getting more kids, especially in urban areas, out into green space, out into parks, out into a little bit of nature and the benefits of doing that. And Mary, I want to follow up on that point, getting kids themselves involved in planning. So why is that important and how are you going to do that?
Right. So we have an event tomorrow at Warner Park, which is on Madison's north side. If you haven't been there, it's a stunning park with 200 acres and conservation land, as well as a really well-equipped community center. It's really a unique property here in the city of Madison that we're proud of. So at that event, we're going to ask a really diverse group of folks to tell us what works. What are our assets in the community around getting kids into nature? What are some of the barriers that we face? We'll have a big group of kids there to help us articulate that. And then what are our dreams? So building on that, we're going to have part of the grant is going to pay for kids this summer to be doing youth engagement. So going out, asking kids where they already are, right, in camps or in other kinds of programs, what do you think you want your green spaces to look like and what would make them attractive to you? It's really not hard to get kids into those spaces. If you make it easy for them, it's something they're naturally drawn to. Their curiosity kind of overcomes any other barrier. So it's going to be a fun summer getting kids to lead that effort.
You mentioning bringing the community on board to help plan this reminds me that a benefit people have pointed to is that having that that park maybe as a gathering place, as a place where people go, it actually builds community resilience because people gather there. Maybe for a birthday party, maybe even nothing that formal. You just see other kids, you see other parents at the park.
That's right. And that's especially important for intergenerational connection. A lot of times we see older adults who are isolated, and who brings them out? It's the kids. So part of what we're hearing from a lot of different places, and especially from kids, is let's design schoolyards, for example, to be nature-based play places, right? So that right there, right nearby, you can access nature in a way that maybe you couldn't when it was either asphalt or just a sort of a flat mown field, right? Much more interesting tactile sensory environments for kids to learn and play. The other piece is that a lot of what we do in public health, if not everything, is research driven. What's the evidence that tells us that this kind of change will make a difference in childhood obesity rates, right? In mental health over time, in kids' ability to use nature as a life skill. So we're looking closely at the evidence that's emerging. And what you do find is that communities with lots of exposure to green space and places for that restorative peace to happen, they find fewer violent crimes going on. They find people feel safer in their communities. A lot of community connectedness happens, as you pointed out, Rob. So we're looking closely at that evidence base.
Now, when people talk about getting kids into nature, I think the image that pops into my mind is out to the woods, out of the city completely, to a natural landscape. But there's evidence you're saying that even just that, you know, one block or smaller park can be part of the solution here?
Exactly. You don't have to have a grand vista, as we say. You don't have to have a really big space. What you do need is some complexity that you don't have to make a lot of effort to have draw kids in, right? It's that sort of lack of effort that's needed to draw you into the curiousness, the wonder, if you will. Taking kids outside in the dark and looking up at the stars can really fundamentally change where they see themselves in the world. So nearby, just great. But that quality of sort of wonder is something that kids often miss.
Now, but green space, does there have to be green? I mean, because there have been parks that have been asphalt and gravel and, I don't know, maybe a couple trees here and there, but that's it. Is it important to really have a majority of the space be not man-made, not rock?
It can certainly be a combination. And a lot of people are actually drawn to water. You know, spending time on water is incredibly helpful for folks and oftentimes therapeutic.
So blue space and green space.
Right, right. Water space. The other piece I think that you're pointing out is that design is important. So the built environment, as we say, is really critical for shaping how people spend their time, the way they feel about themselves and their neighborhoods. And this sort of connection to nature should, and we say, should be an essential piece of what we find in cities. So a nature-rich city is really what we're after.
We're talking about getting kids outside into even a little piece of nature, like the neighborhood park. Mary Michaud is with us. She's policy director for Public Health Madison and Dane County. A new initiative picked Madison as one of seven cities around the country, part of an effort to figure out what's going to work, what's going to provide this kind of space and access to that space for kids of all ethnic and economic backgrounds. We want to hear from you now at 800-642-1234. How important do you think this is for kids, for your kids, for your childhood? Do you try to get your kids outside more? What do we lose when we don't have these opportunities? What's going on in your town, your city, your neighborhood? Do you see kids playing at the park? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Central Time Facebook page. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're continuing our conversation about the health benefits and other benefits of getting outdoors, especially for kids. Madison was recently named as part of the Cities Connecting Children to Nature initiative, one of seven cities around the country. The initiative aims to encourage children, especially in urban areas, to get outside and into parks and green space. Mary Michaud is policy director for Public Health Madison and Dane County, and we're talking about why getting outdoors is good for our health and the well-being of our communities. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you feel like kids today have enough opportunity, enough places to go, enough friendly landscapes to get outside? What did you get as a kid or for your kids out of having those kind of parks, wild areas to get out in? Call in now. Tell us what's going on in your part of the state, in your schools, baby. Call 800-642-1234 or visit the Central Time Facebook page. Go right to a caller. We've got Maddie on the line in Waupaca. Maddie, hi.
Hi. Joy Cardine had a guy on her show on March 2nd, and he did eye research, and he said that the children are not getting enough daylight in their eyes, and it's actually affecting the shape of their eyes. And he said that more and more, there are going to be more and more kids that are going to be nearsighted. And during the growing years up to the age of 25, he said it's absolutely vital that they get daylight in their eyes.
Maddie, thanks for that call. So physical, you were starting to get into some of the health benefits, some really specific health benefits, I guess, of getting outside.
Right. And I mean, if it's a great point, Maddie, and I think that if you think about how we've evolved as humans, right, it's only in the last couple of hundred years that we've lived in really urban areas, only in the last 2 years that most of the world is living in urban areas. So we had lots of green space around us over time. And it turns out that we're really programmed that way to sort of have this affinity for green space and affinity for nature. If you ask a room full of people, tell me a place that you really feel at peace, chances are most of them are going to say somewhere in nature, right? So it's pretty profound, and so much more of the research now is focused on really testing those theories, and it's turning out to be true.
Maddie, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. We heard from Julie in Toma, who couldn't stay on the line, but she said this sounds like a great opportunity. She says there are lots of outdoor options for her boys in Toma, and she notices differences in their behavior when they don't spend as much time outside. Definitely as a parent, I've been there when the kids are cooped up too long because of weather or something like that. You just need that little bit of time outside. So physical benefits, community benefits, behavioral benefits too, it sounds like. Mary.
It's true. So we see a pretty big rise, too, in what we call autism spectrum disorders. We see a rise in attention differences among children. Part of that's diagnosis, but part of it's very real. And what you see is that time outside for kids with sensory differences or attention differences, right, can really be beneficial in helping them adapt when they come back inside. It helps remove that fatigue from focusing. It takes effort, and it turns out that time in nature and that heavy work, we call it, that sort of big motor play, mm-hmm. can really calm kids so that they can actually turn to things like reading or math or things that require small motor skills, like tactile skills. So it can be really helpful for those kids as well.
Talking to Mary Michaud, Policy Director for Public Health Madison in Dane County, talking about efforts to get kids outside. Still time for your calls at 800-642-1234. Do you notice a difference when kids are have time outside in nature and when they don't? What's happening in your community? Are there enough parks for kids to get out and play in? 800-642-1234 is the number to call. You mentioned earlier, Mary, access, equity, making sure people have access to these parks in their own neighborhoods. When you talk about race in Wisconsin and in Madison, a disparity is a word that comes up a lot. Education, income, you were mentioning earlier health. So how does that play into this discussion?
It plays in quite profoundly. So one of the efforts we're trying to make through this initiative is to really connect to organizations that have local trust. So organizations that have been in the community a long time that serve children and families of color can incorporate, and in many cases already are incorporating these kinds of activities, but it's a tough thing to put enough resources together to do that well, right? Transportation is often the issue. You know, we see the Aldo Leopold Nature Center doing really, really good things in terms of in-reach into the schools and then providing transportation, too. We see parks doing that. We see the Madison School and Community Recreation Programming doing that. So there are a lot of efforts being made. They're not particularly well coordinated, and I don't think anybody would argue that that's the case. And it's not unique to Madison. What we do have is over 260 Madison parks. It's astounding. We have 5,500 acres of parkland with 19 conservation parks. This is an unbelievable asset in our community, and to use that to its full extent for healing, for physical well-being, and for community building is really a key goal of what we're trying to do.
Let's bring our callers back in. We've got Richard on the line in Huntsley, Illinois. Richard, hi.
Hi. Well, I've been an educator of preschool children for 30 years as a parent. And also, I was just listening, and I really enjoy this, but what I'm saying is that I spent a great deal amount of time outdoors as an environmental education teacher, but I don't see anybody outdoors anymore, unless it's a sport, unless it's driven in a car, and then you get and you go, and to me, I don't see it happening.
Richard, thanks for that call. So people talk about overprogrammed kids sometimes, and he said he only sees kids outside for maybe that organized sports league. Is that part of the goal here, to have that unstructured time where you just go out and be outside?
It certainly is. I think, you know, and I'm a parent too, of two fabulous kids who might be listening right now. It's really important to have us take a moment and build that free, unstructured playtime into our kids' lives and really make that possible. There's so many distractions. There's so many expectations already. I think the other thing is to look for resources in your community, and certainly we have them here. Community Groundworks is an organization locally that trains teachers to take kids out and get hands-on education experiences in their own schoolyards. And it's been really pretty powerful to see that learning community of teachers grow and expand now that Community Groundworks is running a statewide initiative, a school garden initiative in Wisconsin people might like to know about, that's funded through a grant. It's actually a health grant through the Wisconsin Partnership Program. So we see a lot of resources coming back, and it's really encouraging to see.
I talked to a lot of public health researchers on the show here, and it seems like there's this trend to try to think more holistically. The health isn't just making sure the vaccinations happen and talking about diet, but it's reaching out to make sure that the community is a healthy place. So that sounds like you're trying to be part of that equation.
That's exactly right, and really moving what we say upstream in sort of the things that affect our health. It turns out that really only 20% or so of our health is shaped by health care, sort of formal health care services. The socioeconomic conditions we find ourselves in, the built environment, those are really, really important. Health care can kind of be what I say the protein on the plate, if you will. Mm-hmm. When you need it, it needs to be really good and high quality. And those periodic checks are incredibly important. But for kids, most of the time, they're out in the world, right? So we're profoundly aware of food insecurity as a problem in our community. We're really very aware of housing instability. Over 1,000 children in our community have suffered housing insecurity in this last year, where they have to move from place to place. So they still need to play. They still need that sort of nature as a life skill, right? That they can go somewhere and find peace. So the other piece is, can they get involved in something where they really feel good about their leadership and that they belong? So that youth engagement piece, this is a great place for us to start that.
Well, I'm probably looking too far ahead here because this is still in the planning stages in some ways. You're just getting the ball rolling. But is the hope here that this isn't just Madison and the other six cities, but that this is going to form a template for other communities around the country?
That's exactly right. And I think that's the vision of the Children and Nature Network, the National League of Cities, working together with partners at the federal level to really discover what we can do to shape the way kids spend their time differently.
I get the sense, if I could ask kind of a personal question, that you're really excited about this. That's not even a question, a statement. But yes, you are?
I am. I grew up out in the country, rural Wisconsin, with four brothers and a sister. And my dad was a naturalist. So this is just a part of my life. And it's one of the sort of self-interested reasons is that the people who tend to choose this path, you know who you are out there, of environmental education, of choosing to spend time with kids and families, are really a great crew. It's a great crowd of people, and they live in the present very much. So I have a lot of affinity for this community, and it's really up to our kids. It's their future, and we need to give them voice.
That's a good place to leave it, Mary. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
I've been talking to Mary Michaud. She's Policy Director for Public Health, Madison, and Dane County. Been talking about Madison's role in a nationwide initiative that aims to get kids outside and into nature more. Still time, by the way, to share your stories over at the Central Time Facebook page. What was your natural space? What was your green space growing up? What is it for your kids these days? Is there enough of it? I'm Rob Ferret. News is next on Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.